Thus it was that because of the ban of the Valar, the voyages of the Dunedain in those days went ever eastward and not westward, from the darkness of the north to the heats of the south, and beyond the south to the nether darkness. And they came even into the inner seas, and sailed about Middle-earth, and glimpsed from their high prows the gates of morning in the east. And the Dunedain came at times to the shores of the great lands, and they took pity on the forsaken world of Middle-earth, and the lords of Numenor set foot again upon the western shores in the dark years of men, and none yet dared to withstand them. For most of the men of that age that sat under the shadow were now grown weak and fearful. And coming among them, the Numenoreans taught them many things. Corn and wine they brought, and they instructed men in the sowing of seed and the grinding of grain, in the hewing of wood and the shaping of stone, and in the ordering of their life, such as it might be in the lands of swift death and little bliss. Then the men of Middle-earth were comforted, and here and there upon the western shores the houseless woods drew back, and men shook off the yoke of the offspring of Morgoth, and unlearned their terror of the dark. And they revered the memory of the tall sea kings, and when they had departed they called them gods, hoping for their return. For at that time the Numenoreans dwelt never long in Middle-earth, nor made there as yet any habitation of their own. Eastward they must sail, but ever west their hearts returned. Now this yearning grew ever greater with the years, and the Numenoreans began to hunger for the undying city that they saw from afar, and the desire of everlasting life to escape from death, and the ending of delight grew strong upon them. And ever as their power and glory grew greater, their unquiet increased. For though the Valar had rewarded the Dunedain with long life, they could not take from them the weariness of the world that comes at last, and they died, even their kings of the seed of Eärendil, and the span of their lives was brief in the eyes of the Eldar. Thus it was that a shadow fell upon them, in which maybe the will of Morgoth was at work that still moved in the world. And the Numenoreans began to murmur, at first in their hearts, and then in open words, against the doom of men, and most of all against the ban, which forbade them to sail into the west. And they said among themselves, "Why do the lords of the west sit there in peace unending, while we must die and go we know not whither, leaving our home and all that we have made? And the Eldar die not, even those that rebelled against the lords. And since we have mastered all seas, and no water is so wild or so wide that our ships cannot overcome it, why should we not go to Avalone, and greet there our friends?" And some there were who said, "Why should we not go even to Aman, and taste there, were it but for a day, the bliss of the powers? Have we not become mighty among the people of Arda?" The Eldar reported these words to the Valar, and Manwë was grieved, seeing a cloud gather on the noontide of Numenor. And he sent messengers to the Dunedain, who spoke earnestly to the king and to all who would listen, concerning the fate and fashion of the world. "The doom of the world," they said, "one alone can change who made it. And were you so to voyage that escaping all deceits and snares you came indeed to Aman, the blessed realm, little would it profit you. For it is not the land of Manwë that makes its people deathless, but the deathless that dwell therein have hallowed the land. And there you would but wither and grow weary the sooner, as moths in a light too strong and steadfast." But the king said, "Does not Eärendil, my forefather, live? Or is he not in the land of Aman?" To which they answered, "You know that he has a fate apart, and was a judge to the firstborn who die not. Yet this also is his doom, that he can never return again to mortal lands, whereas you and your people are not of the firstborn, but are mortal men, as Ilúvatar made you. Yet it seems that you desire now to have the good of both kindreds, to sail to Valinor when you will, and to return when you please to your homes. That cannot be. Nor can the Valar take away the gifts of Ilúvatar. The Eldar, you say, are unpunished, and even those who rebelled do not die. Yet that is to them neither reward nor punishment, but the fulfillment of their being. They cannot escape, and are bound to this world, never to leave it so long as it lasts, for its life is theirs. And you are punished for the rebellion of men, you say, in which you had small part, and so it is that you die. But that was not at first appointed for a punishment. Thus you escape and leave the world, and are not bound to it in hope or in weariness. Which of us, therefore, should envy the others? And the Numenoreans answered, Why should we not envy the Valar, or even the least of the deathless? For of us is required a blind trust and a hope without assurance, knowing not what lies before us in a little while. And yet we also love the earth, and would not lose it. Then the messengers said, Indeed, the mind of Ilúvatar concerning you is not known to the Valar, and he has not revealed all things that are to come. But this we hold to be true, that your home is not here, neither in the land of Aman, nor anywhere within the circles of the world. And the doom of men, that they should depart, was at first a gift of Ilúvatar. It became a grief to them only because, coming under the shadow of Morgoth, it seemed to them that they were surrounded by a great darkness of which they were afraid, and some grew willful and proud and would not yield until life was reft from them. We who bear the ever-mounting burden of the years do not clearly understand this. But if that grief has returned to trouble you, as you say, then we fear that the shadow arises once more and grows again in your hearts. Therefore, though you be the Dúnedain, fairest of men, who escaped from the shadow of old and fought valiantly against it, we say to you, beware. The will of Eru may not be gainsaid, and the Valar bid you earnestly not to withhold the trust to which you are called, lest soon it become again a bond by which you are constrained. Hope rather that in the end even the least of your desires shall have fruit. The love of Arda was set in your hearts by Ilúvatar, and he does not plant to no purpose. Nonetheless, many ages of men unborn may pass ere that purpose is made known, and to you it will be revealed, and not to the Valar. These things took place in the days of Tar-Kiriatan, the shipbuilder, and of Tar-Atanamir, his son. And they were proud men, eager for wealth, and they laid the men of Middle-earth under tribute, taking now rather than giving. It was to Tar-Atanamir that the messengers came, and he was the 13th king, and in his day the realm of Numenor had endured for more than 2,000 years, and was come to the zenith of its bliss, if not yet of its power. But Atanamir was ill-pleased with the counsel of the messengers, and gave little heed to it, and the greater part of his people followed him. For they wished still to escape death in their own day, not waiting upon hope. And Atanamir lived to a great age, clinging to his life beyond the end of all joy. And he was the first of the Numenoreans to do this, refusing to depart until he was witless and unmanned, and denying to his son the kingship at the height of his days. For the lords of Numenor had been wont to wed late in their long lives, and to depart and leave the mastery to their sons when these were come to full stature of body and mind. Then Tar and Calimon, son of Atanamir, became king, and he was of like mind. And in his day the people of Numenor became divided. On the one hand was the greater party, and they were called the king's men, and they grew proud and were estranged from the Eldar and the Valar. And on the other hand was the lesser party, and they were called the Elendili, the elf friends. for though they remained loyal indeed to the king and the house of Elros, they wished to keep the friendship of the Eldar, and they hearkened to the counsel of the lords of the West. Nonetheless, even they, who named themselves the Faithful, did not wholly escape from the affliction of their people, and they were troubled by the thought of death. Thus the bliss of Westerness became diminished, but still its might and splendor increased. For the kings and their people had not yet abandoned wisdom, and if they loved the Valar no longer, at least they still feared them. They did not dare openly to break the ban, or to sail beyond the limits that had been appointed. Eastward still they steered their tall ships. But the fear of death grew ever darker upon them, and they delayed it by all means that they could. And they began to build great houses for their dead, while their wise men labored unceasingly to discover, if they might, the secret of recalling life, or at the least, of the prolonging of men's days. Yet they achieved only the art of preserving incorrupt the dead flesh of men, and they filled all the land with silent tombs, in which the thought of death was enshrined in the darkness. But those that lived turned the more eagerly to pleasure and revelry, desiring ever more goods and more riches. And after the days of Tar and Calimon, the offering of the first fruits to Eru was neglected, and men went seldom any more to the Hallow upon the heights of Meneltarma in the midst of the land. Thus it came to pass in that time that the Numenoreans first made great settlements upon the west shores of the ancient lands, for their own land seemed to them shrunken, and they had no rest or content therein, and they desired now wealth and dominion in Middle-earth, since the west was denied. Great harbours and strong towers they made, and there many of them took up their abode. But they appeared now rather as lords and masters and gatherers of tribute than as helpers and teachers. And the great ships of the Numenoreans were borne east on the winds and returned ever laden, and the power and majesty of their kings were increased, and they drank and they feasted, and they clad themselves in silver and gold. In all this the elf friends had small part. They alone came now ever to the north and the land of Gil-galad, keeping their friendship with the elves and lending them aid against Sauron. And their haven was Pelagir, above the mouths of Anduin the Great. But the king's men sailed far away to the south, and the lordships and strongholds that they made have left many rumours in the legends of men. In this age, as is elsewhere told, Sauron arose again in Middle-earth, and grew, and turned back to the evil in which he was nurtured by Morgoth, becoming mighty in his service. Already in the days of Tar Minastir, the 11th king of Numenor, he had fortified the land of Mordor, and had built there the tower of Barad-dûr. And thereafter he strove ever for the dominion of Middle-earth, to become a king over all kings, and as a god unto men. And Sauron hated the Numenoreans, because of the deeds of their fathers and their ancient alliance with the elves, and allegiance to the Valar. Nor did he forget the aid that Tar Minastir had rendered to Gil-galad of old, in that time when the One Ring was forged, and there was war between Sauron and the elves in Eriador. Now he learned that the kings of Numenor had increased in power and splendor, and he hated them the more, and he feared them, lest they should invade his lands and wrest from him the dominion of the East. But for a long time he did not dare to challenge the lords of the sea, and he withdrew from the coasts. Yet Sauron was ever guileful, and it is said that among those whom he ensnared with the Nine Rings, three were great lords of Numenorean race. And when the Ulairi arose that were the ring-wraiths, his servants, and the strength of his terror and mastery over men had grown exceedingly great, he began to assail the strong places of the Numenoreans upon the shores of the sea. In those days, the shadow grew deeper upon Numenor, and the lives of the kings of the House of Elros waned because of their rebellion. But they hardened their hearts the more against the Valar. And the 19th king took the scepter of his fathers, and he ascended the throne in the name of Adun Akhor, Lord of the West, forsaking the elven tongues and forbidding their use in his hearing. Yet in the Scroll of Kings, the name Heru Numen was inscribed in the high elven speech because of ancient custom, which the kings feared to break utterly, lest evil befall. Now this title seemed to the faithful overproud, being the title of the Valar, and their hearts were sorely tried between their loyalty to the House of Elros and their reverence of the appointed powers. But worse was yet to come. For Ar-Gimilzor, the 22nd king, was the greatest enemy of the faithful. In his day, the white tree was untended and began to decline, and he forbade utterly the use of the elven tongues, and punished those that welcomed the ships of Eressëa, that still came secretly to the west shores of the land. Now the Elendili dwelt mostly in the western regions of Numenor, but Ar-Gimilzor commanded all that he could discover to be of this party to remove from the west and dwell in the east of the land, and there they were watched. And the chief dwelling of the faithful in the later days was thus nigh to the harbour of Romenna. Thence many set sail to Middle-earth, seeking the northern coasts where they might speak still with the Eldar in the kingdom of Gil-galad. This was known to the kings, but they hindered it not, so long as the Elendili departed from their land and did not return, for they desired to end all friendship between their people and the Eldar of Eressëa, whom they named the Spies of the Valar, hoping to keep their deeds and their counsels hidden from the lords of the West. But all that they did was known to Manwë, and the Valar were wroth with the kings of Numenor, and gave them counsel and protection no more. And the ships of Eressëa came never again out of the sunset, and the havens of Andunia were forlorn. Highest in honour, after the house of the kings, were the lords of Andunia, for they were of the line of Elros, being descended from Silmarion, daughter of Tar-Elendil, the 4th king of Numenor. And these lords were loyal to the kings, and revered them. And the lord of Andunia was ever among the chief counsellors of the scepter. Yet also from the beginning they bore especial love to the Eldar and reverence for the Valar. And as the shadow grew, they aided the faithful as they could. But for long they did not declare themselves openly, and sought rather to amend the hearts of the lords of the scepter with wiser counsels. There was a lady, Inzilbeth, renowned for her beauty, and her mother was Lindoria, sister of Eärendur, the lord of Andunia, in the days of Ar-Sakalthor, father of Ar-Gimilzor. Gimilzor took her to wife, though this was little to her liking, for she was in heart one of the faithful, being taught by her mother. But the kings and their sons were grown proud, and not to be gainsaid in their wishes. No love was there between Ar-Gimilzor and his queen, or between their sons. Inziladun, the elder, was like his mother in mind as in body. But Gimilchad, the younger, went with his father, unless he were yet prouder and more wilful. To him Ar-Gimilzor would have yielded the scepter rather than to the elder son, if the laws had allowed. But when Inziladun acceded to the scepter, he took again a title in the elven tongue as of old, calling himself Tar-Palantir, for he was far-sighted both in eye and in mind, and even those that hated him feared his words as those of a true seer. He gave peace for a while to the faithful, and he went once more at due seasons to the hallow of Eru upon the Meneltarma, which Ar-Gimilzor had forsaken. The white tree he tended again with honour, and he prophesied, saying that when the tree perished, then also would the line of the kings come to its end. But his repentance was too late to appease the anger of the Valar with the insolence of his fathers, of which the greater part of his people did not repent. And Kimilchad was strong and ungentle, and he took the leadership of those that had been called the king's men, and opposed the will of his brother as openly as he dared, and yet more in secret. Thus the days of Tar-Palantir became darkened with grief, and he would spend much of his time in the west, and there ascended often the ancient tower of King Minas Tirith upon the hill of Oromet, nigh to Andunia, whence he gazed westward in yearning, hoping to see, maybe, some sail upon the sea. But no ship came ever again from the west to Numenor, and Avalone was veiled in cloud. Now Gimilchad died 2 years before his 200th year, which was accounted an early death for one of Elros' line, even in its waning. But this brought no peace to the king. For Pharazôn, son of Gimilchad, had become a man yet more restless and eager for wealth and power than his father. He had fared often abroad as a leader in the wars that the Numenoreans made then in the coastlands of Middle-earth, seeking to extend their dominion over men. And thus he had won great renown as a captain both by land and by sea. Therefore, when he came back to Numenor, hearing of his father's death, the hearts of the people were turned to him, for he brought with him great wealth and was for the time free in his giving. And it came to pass that Tar-Palantir grew weary of grief and died. He had no son, but a daughter only, whom he named Miriel in the elven tongue. And to her now by right and the laws of the Numenoreans came the scepter. But Pharazôn took her to wife against her will, doing evil in this and evil also, in that the laws of Numenor did not permit the marriage, even in the royal house, of those more nearly akin than cousins in the second degree. And when they were wedded, he seized the scepter into his own hand, taking the title of Ar-Pharazôn, Tar-Kalion in the elven tongue. And the name of his queen he changed to Ar-Zimrafel. The mightiest and proudest was Ar-Pharazôn the Golden, of all those that had wielded the scepter of the Sea Kings since the foundation of Numenor. And 23 kings and queens had ruled the Numenoreans before, and slept now in their deep tombs under the mount of Meneltarma, lying upon beds of gold. And sitting upon his carven throne in the city of Armenelos, in the glory of his power, he brooded darkly, thinking of war. For he had learned in Middle-earth of the strength of the realm of Sauron, and of his hatred of Westerness. And now there came to him the masters of ships and captains returning out of the east, and they reported that Sauron was putting forth his might, since Ar-Pharazôn had gone back from Middle-earth, and he was pressing down upon the cities by the coasts. And he had taken now the title of King of Men, and declared his purpose to drive the Numenoreans into the sea and destroy even Numenor, if that might be. Great was the anger of Ar-Pharazôn at these tidings, and as he pondered long in secret, his heart was filled with the desire of power unbounded and the sole dominion of his will, and he determined, without counsel of the Valar or the aid of any wisdom but his own, that the title King of Men he would himself claim, and would compel Sauron to become his vassal and his servant. For in his pride he deemed that no king should ever arise so mighty as to vie with the heir of Earendil. Therefore he began in that time to smithy great hoard of weapons, and many ships of war he built, and stored them with his arms. And when all was made ready, he himself set sail with his host into the east. And men saw his sails coming up out of the sunset, dyed as with scarlet and gleaming with red and gold, and fear fell upon the dwellers by the coasts, and they fled far away. But the fleet came at last to that place that was called Umbar. Where was the mighty haven of the Numenoreans that no hand had wrought? Empty and silent were all the lands about when the king of the sea marched upon Middle-earth. For 7 days he journeyed, with banner and trumpet, and he came to a hill, and he went up, and he set there his pavilion and his throne. And he sat him down in the midst of the land, and the tents of his host were ranged all about him, blue, golden, and white, as a field of tall flowers. Then he sent forth heralds, and he commanded Sauron to come before him and swear to him fealty. And Sauron came. Even from his mighty tower of Barad-dûr he came, and made no offer of battle. For he perceived that the power and majesty of the kings of the sea surpassed all rumour of them, so that he could not trust even the greatest of his servants to withstand them, and he saw not his time yet to work his will with the Dunedain. And he was crafty, well skilled to gain what he would by subtlety, when force might not avail. Therefore he humbled himself before Ar-Pharazôn, and smoothed his tongue, and men wondered, for all that he said seemed fair and wise. But Ar-Pharazôn was not yet deceived, and it came into his mind that, for the better keeping of Sauron, and of his oaths of fealty, he should be brought to Numenor, there to dwell as a hostage for himself and all his servants in Middle-earth. To this Sauron assented as one constrained, yet in his secret thought he received it gladly, for it chimed indeed with his desire. And Sauron passed over the sea, and looked upon the land of Numenor, and on the city of Armenolos in the days of its glory, and he was astounded. But his heart within was filled the more with envy and hate. Yet such was the cunning of his mind and mouth, and the strength of his hidden will, that ere 3 years had passed he had become closest to the secret counsels of the king. For flattery, sweet as honey, was ever on his tongue, and knowledge he had of many things yet unrevealed to men. And seeing the favour that he had of their lord, all the counsellors began to fawn upon him, save one alone, Amandil, lord of Andunya. Then slowly a change came over the land, and the hearts of the elf friends were sorely troubled, and many fell away out of fear. And although those that remained still called themselves the Faithful, their enemies named them rebels. For now, having the ears of men, Sauron with many arguments gainsaid all that the Valar had taught, and he bade men think that in the world, in the east and even in the west, there lay yet many seas and many lands for their winning, wherein was wealth uncounted. And still, if they should at the last come to the end of those lands and seas, beyond all lay the ancient darkness. And out of it the world was made, for darkness alone is worshipful, and the Lord thereof may yet make other worlds to be gifts to those that serve him, so that the increase of their power shall find no end. And Ar-Pharazôn said, Who is the Lord of the Darkness? Then behind locked doors Sauron spoke to the king, and he lied, saying, It is he whose name is not now spoken. For the Valar have deceived you concerning him, putting forward the name of Eru. A phantom, devised in the folly of their hearts, seeking to entrain men in servitude to themselves, for they are the oracle of this Eru, which speaks only what they will. But he that is their master shall yet prevail, and he will deliver you from this phantom, and his name is Melkor, Lord of all, giver of freedom, and he shall make you stronger than they. Then Ar-Pharazôn the king turned back to the worship of the dark, and of Melkor, the lord thereof, at first in secret, but ere long openly and in the face of his people. And they for the most part followed him. Yet there dwelt still a remnant of the faithful, as has been told, at Romena, and in the country near, and other few there were here and there in the land. The chief among them, to whom they looked for leading and courage in evil days, was Amandil, counsellor of the king, and his son Elendil, whose sons were Isildur and Anarion, then young men by the reckoning of Numenor. Amandil and Elendil were great ship captains, and they were of the line of Elros Tar-Minyatur, though not of the ruling house, to whom belonged the crown and the throne in the city of Armenelos. In the days of their youth together, Amandil had been dear to Pharazôn, and though he was of the elf friends, he remained in his council until the coming of Sauron. Now he was dismissed, for Sauron hated him above all others in Numenor. But he was so noble, and had been so mighty a captain of the sea, that he was still held in honour by many of the people, and neither the king nor Sauron dared to lay hands on him as yet. Therefore Amandil withdrew to Romena, and all that he trusted still to be faithful he summoned to come thither in secret, for he feared that evil would now grow apace, and all the elf friends were in peril. And so it soon came to pass. For the Menil Tarma was utterly deserted in those days, and though not even Sauron dared to defile the high place, yet the king would let no man, upon pain of death, ascend to it, not even those of the faithful who kept Ilúvatar in their hearts. And Sauron urged the king to cut down the white tree, Nimloth the Fair, that grew in his courts, for it was a memorial of the Eldar and of the light of Valinor. At the first the king would not assent to this, since he believed that the fortunes of his house were bound up with the tree, as was forespoken by Tar-Palantir. Thus in his folly, he who now hated the Eldar and the Valar vainly clung to the shadow of the old allegiance of Numenor. But when Amandil heard rumour of the evil purpose of Sauron, he was grieved to the heart, knowing that in the end Sauron would surely have his will. Then he spoke to Elendil and the sons of Elendil, recalling the tale of the trees of Valinor. And Isildur said no word, but went out by night and did a deed for which he was afterwards renowned. For he passed alone in disguise to Armenolos and into the courts of the king, which were now forbidden to the faithful. And he came to the place of the tree, which was forbidden to all by the orders of Sauron. And the tree was watched by day and night by guards in his service. At that time Nimloth was dark and bore no bloom, for it was late in the autumn, and its winter was nigh. And Isildur passed through the guards, and took from the tree a fruit that hung upon it, and turned to go. But the guard was aroused, and he was assailed, and fought his way out, receiving many wounds, and he escaped. And because he was disguised, it was not discovered who had laid hands on the tree. But Isildur came at last hardly back to Romena, and delivered the fruit to the hands of Amandil, ere his strength failed him. Then the fruit was planted in secret, and it was blessed by Amandil, and a shoot arose from it and sprouted in the spring. But when its first leaf opened, then Isildur, who had lain long and come near to death, arose and was troubled no more by his wounds. None too soon was this done, for after the assault the king yielded to Sauron and felled the white tree, and turned then wholly away from the allegiance of his fathers. But Sauron caused to be built upon the hill, in the midst of the city of the Numenorians, Armenelos the Golden, a mighty temple. And it was in the form of a circle at the base, and there the walls were 50 feet in thickness, and the width of the base was 500 feet across the centre. And the walls rose from the ground 500 feet, and they were crowned with a mighty dome. And that dome was roofed all with silver, and rose glittering in the sun, so that the light of it could be seen afar off. But soon the light was darkened, and the silver became black. For there was an altar of fire in the midst of the temple, and in the topmost of the dome there was a louver, whence there issued a great smoke. And the first fire upon the altar Sauron kindled with the hewn wood of Nimloth. And it crackled and was consumed. But men marvelled at the reek that went up from it, so that the land lay under a cloud for 7 days, until slowly it passed into the west. Thereafter the fire and smoke went up without ceasing, for the power of Sauron daily increased, and in that temple, with spilling of blood and torment and great wickedness, men made sacrifice to Melkor, that he should release them from death. And most often from among the faithful they chose their victims. Yet never openly on the charge that they would not worship Melkor, the giver of freedom. Rather was cause sought against them that they hated the king and were his rebels, or that they plotted against their kin, devising lies and poisons. These charges were for the most part false. Yet those were bitter days, and hate brings forth hate. But for all this, death did not depart from the land. Rather, it came sooner and more often, and in many dreadful guises. For whereas aforetime men had grown slowly old, and had laid them down in the end to sleep, when they were weary at last of the world, now madness and sickness assailed them. And yet they were afraid to die, and go out into the dark, the realm of the Lord that they had taken. And they cursed themselves in their agony. And men took weapons in those days and slew one another for little cause, for they were become quick to anger. And Sauron, or those whom he had bound to himself, went about the land setting man against man, so that the people murmured against the king and the lords, or against any that had aught that they had not. And the men of power took cruel revenge. Nonetheless, for long it seemed to the Numenoreans that they prospered, and if they were not increased in happiness, yet they grew more strong, and their rich men ever richer. For with the aid and counsel of Sauron, they multiplied their possessions, and they devised engines, and they built ever greater ships. And they sailed now with power and armory to Middle-earth, and they came no longer as bringers of gifts, nor even as rulers, but as fierce men of war. And they hunted the men of Middle-earth, and took their goods and enslaved them, and many they slew cruelly upon their altars. For they built in their fortresses temples and great tombs in those days, and men feared them, and the memory of the kindly kings of the ancient days faded from the world, and was darkened by many a tale of dread. Thus Ar-Pharazôn, king of the land of the star, grew to the mightiest tyrant that had yet been in the world since the reign of Morgoth, though in truth Sauron ruled all from behind the throne. But the years passed, and the king felt the shadow of death approach, as his days lengthened, and he was filled with fear and wrath. Now came the hour that Sauron had prepared and long had awaited. And Sauron spoke to the king, saying that his strength was now so great that he might think to have his will in all things and be subject to no command or ban. And he said, "The Valar have possessed themselves of the land where there is no death, and they lie to you concerning it, hiding it as best they may because of their avarice and their fear, lest the kings of men should wrest from them the deathless realm and rule the world in their stead. And though, doubtless, the gift of life unending is not for all, but only for such as are worthy, being men of might and pride and great lineage, yet against all justice is it done that this gift, which is his due, should be withheld from the king of kings, Ar-Pharazôn, mightiest of the sons of Earth, to whom Manwë alone can be compared, if even he. But great kings do not brook denials, and take what is their due. Then Ar-Pharazôn, being besotted and walking under the shadow of death, for his span was drawing towards its end, hearkened to Sauron, and he began to ponder in his heart how he might make war upon the Valar. He was long preparing this design, and he spoke not openly of it, yet it could not be hidden from all. And Amandil, becoming aware of the purposes of the king, was dismayed and filled with a great dread, for he knew that men could not vanquish the Valar in war, and that ruin must come upon the world if this war were not stayed. Therefore he called his son Elendil, and he said to him, "The days are dark, and there is no hope for men, for the faithful are few. Therefore I am minded to try that counsel which our forefather Earendil took of old, to sail into the west, be there ban or no, and to speak to the Valar, even to Manwë himself, if may be, and beseech his aid ere all is lost." "Would you then betray the king?" said Elendil. "For you know well the charge that they make against us, that we are traitors and spies, and that until this day it has been false." "If I thought that Manwë needed such a messenger," said Amandil, "I would betray the king. For there is but one loyalty from which no man can be absolved in heart for any cause. But it is for mercy upon men, and their deliverance from Sauron the Deceiver, that I would plead, since some at least have remained faithful. And as for the ban, I will suffer in myself the penalty, lest all my people should become guilty. But what think you, my father, is like to befall those of your house whom you leave behind when your deed becomes known?"
"It must not become known," said Amandil.
"I will prepare my going in secret, and I will set sail into the east whither daily the ships depart from our havens. And thereafter, as wind and chance may allow, I will go about, through south or north, back into the west, and seek what I may find. But for you and your folk, my son, I counsel that you should prepare yourselves other ships and put aboard all such things as your hearts cannot bear to part with. And when the ships are ready, you should lie in the haven of Romenna, and give out among men that you purpose, when you see your time, to follow me into the east. Amandil is no longer so dear to our kinsmen upon the throne that he will grieve over much if we seek to depart for a season or for good. But let it not be seen that you intend to take many men, or he will be troubled because of the war that he now plots, for which he will need all the force that he may gather. Seek out the faithful that are known still to be true, and let them join you in secret if they are willing to go with you and share in your design."
"And what shall that design be?" said Elendil.
"To meddle not in the war and to watch," answered Amandil. "Until I return, I can say no more. But it is most like that you shall fly from the land of the star with no star to guide you, for that land is defiled. Then you shall lose all that you have loved, foretasting death in life, seeking a land of exile elsewhere. But east or west, the Valar alone can say." Then Amandil said farewell to all his household as one that is about to die. "For," said he, "it may well prove that you shall see me never again, and that I shall show you no such sign as Earendil showed long ago. But hold you ever in readiness, for the end of the world that we have known is now at hand." It is said that Amandil set sail in a small ship at night, and steered first eastward, and then went about and passed into the west. And he took with him three servants dear to his heart, and never again were they heard of by word or sign in this world, nor is there any tale or guess of their fate. Men could not a second time be saved by any such embassy, and for the treason of Numenor there was no easy absolving. But Elendil did all that his father had bidden, and his ships lay off the east coast of the land. And the faithful put aboard their wives and their children and their heirlooms and great store of goods. Many things there were of beauty and power, such as the Numenoreans had contrived in the days of their wisdom, vessels and jewels, and scrolls of lore written in scarlet and black. And 7 stones they had, the gift of the Eldar. But in the ship of Isildur was guarded the young tree, the scion of Nimloth the Fair. Thus Elendil held himself in readiness, and did not meddle in the evil deeds of those days, and ever he looked for a sign that did not come. Then he journeyed in secret to the western shores, and gazed out over the sea, for sorrow and yearning were upon him, and he greatly loved his father. But naught could he descry save the fleets of Ar-Pharazôn gathering in the havens of the west. Now aforetime in the isle of Numenor the weather was ever apt to the needs and liking of men, rain in due season and ever in measure, and sunshine now warmer, now cooler, and winds from the sea. And when the wind was in the west, it seemed to many that it was filled with a fragrance, fleeting but sweet, heart-stirring, as of flowers that bloom forever in undying meads and have no names on mortal shores. But all this was now changed, for the sky itself was darkened, and there were storms of rain and hail in those days, and violent winds, and ever and anon a great ship of the Numenoreans would founder and return not to haven, though such a grief had not till then befallen them since the rising of the star. And out of the west there would come at times a great cloud in the evening, shaped as it were an eagle, with pinions spread to the north and the south. And slowly it would loom up, blotting out the sunset, and then uttermost night would fall upon Numenor. And some of the eagles bore lightning beneath their wings, and thunder echoed between sea and cloud. Then men grew afraid. "Behold, the eagles of the lords of the west," they cried. "The eagles of Manwë are come upon Numenor." And they fell upon their faces. Then some few would repent, for a season, but others hardened their hearts, and they shook their fists at heaven, saying, "The lords of the west have plotted against us. They strike first. The next blow shall be ours." These words the king himself spoke, but they were devised by Sauron. Now the lightnings increased and slew men upon the hills, and in the fields, and in the streets of the city, and a fiery bolt smote the dome of the temple and shore it asunder, and it was wreathed in flame. But the temple itself was unshaken, and Sauron stood there upon the pinnacle and defied the lightning and was unharmed. And in that hour men called him a god and did all that he would. When therefore the last portent came, they heeded it little, for the land shook under them, and a groaning as of thunder underground was mingled with the roaring of the sea, and smoke issued from the peak of the Meneltarma. But all the more did Ar-Pharazôn press on with his armament. In that time the fleets of the Numenoreans darkened the sea upon the west of the land, and they were like an archipelago of 1,000 isles. Their masts were as a forest upon the mountains, and their sails like a brooding cloud, and their banners were golden and black, and all things waited upon the word of Ar-Pharazôn. And Sauron withdrew into the inmost circle of the temple, and men brought him victims to be burned. Then the eagles of the lords of the west came up out of the dayfall, and they were arrayed as for battle, advancing in a line the end of which diminished beyond sight. And as they came, their wings spread ever wider, grasping the sky. But the west burned red behind them, and they glowed beneath, as though they were lit with a flame of great anger, so that all Numenor was illumined as with a smouldering fire. And men looked upon the faces of their fellows, and it seemed to them that they were red with wrath. Then Ar-Pharazôn hardened his heart, and he went aboard his mighty ship, Al-Carondas, castle of the sea. Many oared it was, and many masted, golden and sable. And upon it the throne of Ar-Pharazôn was set. Then he did on his panoply and his crown, and let raise his standard, and he gave the signal for the raising of the anchors. And in that hour the trumpets of Numenor outrang the thunder. Thus the fleets of the Numenoreans moved against the menace of the west, and there was little wind, but they had many oars and many strong slaves to row beneath the lash. The sun went down, and there came a great silence. Darkness fell upon the land, and the sea was still, while the world waited for what should betide. Slowly the fleets passed out of the sight of the watchers in the havens, and their lights faded, and night took them, and in the morning they were gone. For a wind arose in the east, and it wafted them away, and they broke the ban of the Valar, and sailed into forbidden seas, going up with war against the deathless, to wrest from them everlasting life within the circles of the world. But the fleets of Ar-Pharazôn came up out of the deeps of the sea, and encompassed Avalone and all the isles of Eressëa. And the Eldar mourned, for the light of the setting sun was cut off by the cloud of the Numenoreans. And at last Ar-Pharazôn came even to Aman, the blessed realm, and the coasts of Valinor. And still all was silent, and doom hung by a thread. For Ar-Pharazôn wavered at the end, and almost he turned back. His heart misgave him when he looked upon the soundless shores, and saw Tanyquetil shining whiter than snow, colder than death, silent, immutable, terrible as the shadow of the light of Ilúvatar. But pride was now his master, and at last he left his ship and strode upon the shore, claiming the land for his own, if none should do battle for it. And a host of the Numenoreans encamped in might about Tunar, whence all the Eldar had fled. Then Manwë, upon the mountain, called upon Ilúvatar, and for that time the Valar laid down their government of Arda. But Ilúvatar showed forth his power, and he changed the fashion of the world. And a great chasm opened in the sea between Numenor and the deathless lands, and the waters flowed down into it, and the noise and smoke of the cataracts went up to heaven, and the world was shaken. And all the fleets of the Numenoreans were drawn down into the abyss, and they were drowned and swallowed up forever. But Ar-Pharazôn the king and the mortal warriors that had set foot upon the land of Aman were buried under falling hills. There it is said that they lie imprisoned in the caves of the Forgotten until the last battle and the day of doom. But the land of Aman and Eressëa of the Eldar were taken away and removed beyond the reach of men forever. And Andor, the land of gift, Numenor of the kings, Elenor of the Star of Eärendil, was utterly destroyed. For it was nigh to the east of the great rift, and its foundations were overturned, and it fell and went down into darkness, and is no more. And there is not now upon earth any place abiding where the memory of a time without evil is preserved. For Ilúvatar cast back the great seas west of Middle-earth, and the empty lands east of it, and new lands and new seas were made, and the world was diminished, for Valinor and Eressëa were taken from it into the realm of hidden things. In an hour unlooked for by men, this doom befell on the 39th day since the passing of the fleets. Then suddenly fire burst from the Meneltarma, and there came a mighty wind and a tumult of the earth, and the sky reeled and the hills slid, and Numenor went down into the sea with all its children and its wives and its maidens and its ladies proud, and all its gardens and its halls and its towers, its tombs and its riches and its jewels and its webs and its things painted and carven, and its laughter and its mirth and its music, its wisdom and its law, they vanished forever. And last of all, the mounting wave, green and cold and plumed with foam, climbing over the land, took to its bosom Tar Miriel the Queen, fairer than silver or ivory or pearls. Too late she strove to ascend the steep ways of the Menel Tarma to the holy place, for the waters overtook her, and her cry was lost in the roaring of the wind. But whether or no it were that Amandil came indeed to Valinor, and Manwë hearkened to his prayer, by grace of the Valar, Elendil and his sons and their people were spared from the ruin of that day. For Elendil had remained in Romenna, refusing the summons of the king when he set forth to war, and avoiding the soldiers of Sauron that came to seize him and drag him to the fires of the temple, he went aboard his ship and stood off from the shore, waiting on the time. There he was protected by the land from the great draught of the sea that drew all towards the abyss, and afterwards he was sheltered from the first fury of the storm. But when the devouring wave rolled over the land and Numenor toppled to its fall, then he would have been overwhelmed and would have deemed it the lesser grief to perish, for no wrench of death could be more bitter than the loss and agony of that day. But the great wind took him, wilder than any wind that men had known, roaring from the west, and it swept his ships far away, and it rent their sails and snapped their masts, hunting the unhappy men like straws upon the water. 9 ships there were, 4 for Elendil, and for Isildur, 3, and for Anarion, 2. And they fled before the black gale out of the twilight of doom into the darkness of the world. And the deeps rose beneath them in towering anger, and waves like unto mountains moving with great caps of writhen snow bore them up amid the wreckage of the clouds, and after many days cast them away upon the shores of Middle-earth. And all the coasts and seaward regions of the western world suffered great change and ruin in that time, for the seas invaded the lands, and shores foundered, and ancient isles were drowned, and new isles were uplifted, and hills crumbled, and rivers were turned into strange courses. Elendil and his sons after founded kingdoms in Middle-earth, and though their lore and craft was but an echo of that which had been ere Sauron came to Numenor, yet very great it seemed to the wild men of the world. And much is said in other lore of the deeds of the heirs of Elendil in the age that came after, and of their strife with Sauron that not yet was ended. For Sauron himself was filled with great fear at the wrath of the Valar, and the doom that Eru laid upon sea and land. It was greater far than aught he had looked for, hoping only for the death of the Numenoreans and the defeat of their proud king. And Sauron, sitting in his black seat in the midst of the temple, had laughed when he heard the trumpets of Ar-Pharazôn sounding for battle. And again he had laughed when he heard the thunder of the storm. And a third time, even as he laughed at his own thought, thinking what he would do now in the world, being rid of the Edain forever, he was taken in the midst of his mirth, and his seat and his temple fell into the abyss. But Sauron was not of mortal flesh, and though he was robbed now of that shape in which he had wrought so great an evil, so that he could never again appear fair to the eyes of men, yet his spirit arose out of the deep, and passed as a shadow and a black wind over the sea, and came back to Middle-earth, and to Mordor, that was his home. There he took up again his great ring in Barad-dûr, and dwelt there, dark and silent, until he wrought himself a new guise, an image of malice and hatred made visible, and the eye of Sauron the Terrible few could endure. But these things come not into the tale of the drowning of Numenor, of which now all is told. And even the name of that land perished, and men spoke thereafter not of Elena, nor of Andor the gift that was taken away, nor of Numenora on the confines of the world. But the exiles on the shores of the sea, if they turned towards the west in the desire of their hearts, spoke of Mar Nufalmar, that was whelmed in the waves, Akalabeth, the downfallen. Atalanta, in the Eldarin tongue. Among the exiles, many believed that the summit of the Meneltarma, the pillar of heaven, was not drowned forever, but rose again above the waves, a lonely island lost in the great waters. For it had been a hallowed place, and even in the days of Sauron none had defiled it. And some there were of the seed of Earendil, that afterwards sought for it, because it was said among lawmasters that the far-sighted men of old could see from the Meneltarma a glimmer of the deathless land. For even after the ruin, the hearts of the Dúnedain were still set westwards. And though they knew indeed that the world was changed, they said, Avalone is vanished from the earth, and the land of Aman is taken away, and in the world of this present darkness they cannot be found. Yet once they were, and therefore they still are, in true being, and in the whole shape of the world, as at first it was devised. For the Dúnedain held that even mortal men, if so blessed, might look upon other times than those of their body's life. And they longed ever to escape from the shadows of their exile, and to see in some fashion the light that dies not. For the sorrow of the thought of death had pursued them over the deeps of the sea. Thus it was that great mariners among them would still search the empty seas, hoping to come upon the isle of Meneltarma, and there to see a vision of things that were. But they found it not. And those that sailed far came only to the new lands, and found them like to the old lands, and subject to death. And those that sailed furthest set but a girdle about the earth, and returned weary at last to the place of their beginning, and they said, All roads are now bent. Thus in after days, what by the voyages of ships, what by lore and starcraft, the kings of men knew that the world was indeed made round. And yet the Eldar were permitted still to depart and to come to the ancient west, and to Avalone if they would. Therefore the lawmasters of men said that a straight road must still be for those that were permitted to find it. And they taught that, while the new world fell away, the old road and the path of the memory of the West still went on, as it were, a mighty bridge invisible that passed through the air of breath and of flight, which were bent now as the world was bent, and traversed Ilmen, which flesh unaided cannot endure, until it came to Tol Eressëa, the lonely isle, and maybe even beyond to Valinor, where the Valar still dwell and watch the unfolding of the story of the world. And tales and rumors arose along the shores of the sea concerning mariners and men forlorn upon the water who, by some fate or grace or favor of the Valar, had entered in upon the straight way and seen the face of the world sink below them, and so had come to the lamplit quays of Avalone, or verily, to the last beaches on the margin of Aman, and there had looked upon the white mountain, dreadful and beautiful, before they died.